So that's the end of our sort of formal presentation, and I guess the organizers of the conference have asked that we, you know, raise a couple of pointed or maybe less pointed questions to spark discussion, and then we're going to facilitate the conversation. And I think we'd both much rather facilitate a conversation that's really a conversation and not a sort of grad school seminar question-answer, see if you can, you know, sound smarter than other people conversation. So keeping that in mind, of course, we're happy to be challenged on things also, and we'll respond, but we're going to try to facilitate and take a speaker's list that way. So a couple of the questions, if these are useful, great, use them. If they're not useful and you have other things in mind that you want to talk about related to the presentation, then that's great too. I guess one question would be, do our examples of sort of the misuses and misconceptions of direct democracy in organizing in anarchist circles right now, do those resonate with experiences here? And have you framed them in similar ways, or was it not useful? And then the other question would be the extent to which you agree that the suggestion that a correct articulation of sort of what is wrong with our society would really cause us to shift the focus away from a sort of, you know, critique of society as being fundamentally undemocratic and toward a critique of society as being fundamentally exploitative, or of, you know, a class being fundamentally exploitative. And then also, would that result in a more substantive model of democracy, potentially a more radical democracy? So those are our two questions. I'll take a speaker's list for a while if people would like to speak.
We've got lots of hands.
So do you want to start? And then I've got you.
I don't know if this directly answers the first question, but in terms of, like, organizational practice, I think membership, definitely, I'd agree with you that maybe, or I don't know if you're really saying this, but I think membership in a group, an anarchist group, definitely creates a sense of accountability and interest in the group, or I hate to use the term investment, but kind of like, you know, feeling part of a group and accountable to the group. I'm in the Valley Anarchist Organization in Western Massachusetts, and we're a membership organization. We have kind of general meetings that decide major policy stuff, but we have project groups, which actually do the activist work of the group and kind of make their own decisions as long as it's not major decisions. And that works kind of pretty well, except there's problems where non-members can work with the project groups but not have any voting power in the general meetings, kind of. Or decision-making power. And also, like, I think membership is definitely problematic, where membership can become like a social clique, almost, if it's misused. It could become elitist. We've been having discussions about having dues or not having dues, and, like, I mean, how do you negotiate that, kind of, because we need money as an organization, but I don't know if that answers the question directly.
I think that the analysis, the critique that you lay down, Andrea, of one strand of libertarianism was thinking was spot on, and I was really happy to hear that coming from Quack folks. But I think that there's a contradiction built into the analysis that both of you laid out around the idea that the better alternative to a wrongly conceived form of direct democracy is some kind of worker self-management. And I think that came out in the OCAP example and in the Clack example, the first example that Blake gave. It seems to me that in the OCAP example, neither the folks who live in that squat nor OCAP militants, I don't understand what the point is of understanding those people as workers who are going to self-manage their workplace. The squat isn't a workplace, and the OCAP militant is, you know, temporarily at a work site, I suppose, for the length of that weekend. But it seems weird to me to say that worker self-management would be a better way to have organized that decision. And I think it's even clearer in the Clack example. I don't know Clack well enough, but I'm guessing that folks who do committee work for a subcommittee of Clack, that's a voluntary thing where you put in your labor because you're committed to the project, but your livelihood isn't tied up in what gets done there. Whereas the Malatesta examples and the Abad de Santillan examples are all about workers whose life, that it's all about your livelihood and how you structure the stuff that you have to do to, you know, just to live. So to my mind, I guess I'd want to point towards something that transcends both of those two limited understandings of how to run a free society, but doesn't play the play the one off the other in that direct way.
I have a couple comments about that, which is yeah, I see your point. I guess I think that the opposition is a useful way more of highlighting some of the current problems than it is as a solution to it. I think, though, that Blake's conclusion about revisioning how we critique our society in terms of exploitation is a useful one, and whether or not that necessarily grows out of envisioning sort of liberatory structures as focusing on workers' control or not is another question. In terms of, maybe this is sort of a nitpicking point, but in terms of sort of labor and how we understand our volunteerism in CLAC or whatever, I think you're right. I mean, most people there don't consider themselves workers, but I'm more and more thinking that that's a problem as I watch how we organize. Because whether or not it really, you know, we don't get paid, we don't have any paid organizers, and there would be a very, very strong resistance, unlike at OCAP, for example, to having paid organizers, which I'm starting to take issue with also. But while you don't directly profit from your organizing work, it's not your livelihood, it infringes on your capacity to have a livelihood. And in that sense, when it's what you do, you know, whatever, 50 hours a week, you know, to the diminishment of your bank account, it is, in some sense, it replaces that in sort of an inverse way. And I'm not saying, I'd have to think about this more, and so thank you for raising the question, but I'm not saying that you then become a worker in the same way a worker in the factory becomes a worker. But it seems to me that we are producing something when we spend 40 hours a week producing a pamphlet for an organization that has mandated a campaign. We are producing something for them and for us. And so there's an extent to which it's still a useful concept, I think. There's a comment over here, and then we'll look afterwards.
Yeah, I think what you were saying was interesting. I saw it kind of a little bit differently, though. When you talk about workers, are you thinking of workers as opposed to bosses, or workers as opposed to the people you call the slackers or the parasites? I've been in a group that's about 15 years old that's kind of a collective of unschooling families, and a lot of the things you said just rang a lot of bells, because we've been through every permutation of having this group now that the core group of workers, people who do the work, kind of identify as whiners, and how to deal with these people and make, you know, and we finally, after years, we've just kind of gone ahead and kind of had this attitude, well, if they call us elitists, we say thank you, as in the sense that, you know, if elitist means we happen to be the people doing all the work, thank you for acknowledging that fact. But it's been very difficult, and finally, this year, and it's been a process of growth, because the way things were negotiated when the group was very small, again, it's always this, you know, and I've heard this is true in any organization, no matter how big it is, there's always this core group that does all of the work. Handful, 12, something like that. And when it was small, we could go ahead and do the work and assume the goodwill of everybody else who wasn't. They were sort of willing to ride on the coattails with us, and there was an understanding that was fine, and it would be reciprocated possibly as these families with very young children, when their children got older. And then the group doubled, and then significant problems began to happen because there was a less cohesiveness, more diversity in a sense. You know, you get, every time there's a school shooting, you know, we get families that are kind of looking for alternatives that don't really understand, you know, you could say are immature or don't have a kind of track record. But so I offer this kind of as a, you know, another story. But in sort of adopting this attitude of sort of being just simply wanting to be immune from the whiners, we've really been able to accomplish so much more, move forward with certain things that we wanted to do, instead of constantly trying to sort of encourage these people to sort of understand, I don't know what to call it, sort of an anarchistic philosophy as opposed to any kind of democratic procedure. So there's that. And then another point, just I mentioned this, in terms of groups even much larger, say, than what I'm talking about, where we have 200 families, but like townships, there's a Australian scholar named Brian Martin who wrote a whole book called Random Selection in Politics, which was an effort to solve some of the problems associated with direct democracy. And he has some very interesting ideas in there about, and so I offer it's...
What's it? Can you repeat his name?
It's called Random Selection Politics. That's by Brian Martin. And he's... I have not read the book in its entirety, but I gather that it's... And I don't want to go on at length, but he has a situation where, like your road-building analogy, people who express interest in given parts of accomplishing something would volunteer. Among this group, which would be quite large, people would be randomly selected to perform a role for a given period of time, and that would change. And his argument is that it's certainly at least as effective as other things that have been practiced, and possibly has many, many more advantages. So, and I thought it was kind of interesting. I think a lot of these problems have to do with scale, numbers, just numbers of people.
Well, I definitely appreciate your analysis of how democracy, I think, is misused in the movement. That being said, I think we have to create opportunities for sort of both strands to happen. I think we do want to create opportunities for people to just literally come in off the street and participate, often for the first time in a directly democratic process. But I think what I've seen happen is we sort of take that model and try and look at it as a universal and adopt it in our long-term organizing, which I think is incredibly problematic. And I do think that membership organizing is really important. I want to create those opportunities for people to come in off the street and participate. And I think that direct actions actually provide that in a nice way for people to actually just plug in into something that's a very short-term project. Then you want to go back to your long-term organization in terms of picking up the pieces, which is also problematic when people come in for the actions and then don't stick around and you feel like you're sort of just grabbing at straws to see who will do the follow-up. That's where I think you don't want to sort of make that mistake and have that be your organization that does the long-term. For me, I feel like in terms of your analysis of moving away from direct democracy and sort of looking more at the worker, I agree with Peter. To me, the idea of rights and duties, no rights without dues, no dues without rights, in many ways, I think, deals with that scenario in a more satisfactory way than the idea of looking at worker control specifically, because I feel like that's too narrow a group of people in terms of, you know, parents and all other sort of factors and elderly people and all the things that can go into that. And I also think that even that is problematic, that the rights and duties things within our movement, because at least in New York, to be active requires, unless you've sort of found a subculture that allows you the space to both, you know, have a livelihood and spend a lot of hours working on a project, you pretty much are seeing people who have privilege along some demographic and don't have kids. And I mean, there's a lot of reasons why those of us who do put in a lot of hours have that freedom to do that. And so I think there needs to be some, I mean, it can't be so hard and fast as those who can show up and give 25 hours a week have more rights than those who can't. But that being said, there are a number of people who will show up weekly at the decision-making meetings and in a way hold the people who are actually doing the work hostage based on decisions that are made at those weekly meetings. And that's just been enormously frustrating. So I'm just, this is a really helpful discussion for me.
Just before we go on, I think Blake might disagree with me because I think Blake and I are somewhere on the same end of the spectrum, but I don't think I'm maybe as into straight-up worker control as the model maybe as you are. And for me, first of all, I don't think we can totally, you know, make the distinction between them, because any model of worker control also assumes a general assembly in which direct democracy is instantiated, right? So, first of all, there's a significant overlap, and it's less to move. I think this discussion is less an attempt to move away from direct democracy than to elaborate a much more mature, longstanding, and long-term vision of what a democratic process is, which is really a process, and it doesn't just begin and end at the beginning of the mobilization or at the beginning of the meeting. So I appreciate, you know, all your comments, and I think, yeah, I can affiliated with that. Blake, did you want to comment on
that? Yeah, I did. I think one of the things you're bringing up there is, who is the project that people are working on responsible to? And in a sense, like, the project I brought up about, say, indie media or, like, just your random anarchist publication not being obligated to publish anything by anybody, I would take people's random submissions that were, I thought, horribly backward and reactionary much more seriously if this were sort of like a communal press in a post-revolutionary society where, it is the means of communication. But I think we have to see, a lot of the things that we're doing, they're just really not, the thing that's happening that, provides that service to an entire community. So I think that there's really quite kind of a difference there. And the other, so that's just one thing I want to say. And the other thing I wanted to say was about worker control and things like that. I think we're not really trying to even enter into the discussion about first of all, I think that if you look at someone like Diego Abad de Santillan, he's actually, he's a bit maligned for focusing too much on workers. Like, even the CNT, they were very clear that people who could not work would be supported by the community. People who, I think there's definitely some critiques there, but I think they sometimes go too far in that sense. Like, people who could not work, the young, the elderly, would be supported by the producers. But I think when we're talking about producers, we're talking about, we're not talking about like your campaign being in a workplace. Like, your campaign could be anywhere. Like, the CLAC doesn't have any labor campaigns, but nevertheless, what Andre was saying earlier is that people in the CLAC do work in the sense that people put up posters and people run around and write pamphlets and go do talks and all that sort of thing. And that's the sort of work we wanted to more focus on, I think.
I guess my comment relates a little bit to what you were saying, is just that I think that there isn't one organizational structure, which I think people always seem to try to find. I think that's something that's partly happening with this sort of thing about, like, we need to be directly democratic, is everybody wants to find the answer. And I think you have to look at the appropriateness of your organizational structure to what your goals are and what the community is, how accountable people are to that community. You have one kind of organization for a municipality where people live and are tied into it by their homes. You have another kind of organization for the workplace. You have another kind of organization for a group that came together to put an action together. You have another kind of organization for people who want to develop along ideological lines. And I just think people throw around the words community a lot, as well as democracy, and I just think, like, are you operating on the basis of affinity groups? Do you have a larger collective that people can join? All those are really important questions, and I don't think you can find one answer. And so I think that all the different organizational structures that people have problems with do work sometimes and are good for some things. But I don't think there is an answer to the way the kind of structure we need.
Well, listening to all this, I'm thinking about my 20 years in co-ops and so many of those battles that, like you described, Andrea, with the mural. And each one of those is sort of a defeat in terms of, in some way, no matter what happens, how it ends up, everyone knows it was stupid and we really didn't accomplish and get to what we were about. So much you could get weighed down with an issue that became far too symbolic beyond what it really was. I feel like we often, and this happens a lot, that the doctrines, and the policies and the process that we have, we take too much faith. We get carried away in faith in that and forget to insist on values that we can't really describe, except to say that we insist on respect and trust and consideration. So instead there's a sense that the process itself is going to
to solve the problem and resolve the issue. And it's up to each one of us really to tack back and to deal with those personal issues toward other people and toward, I guess, from the those that are on the in the inner clique, the ones that do more of the work or are more involved, to consider where the isolates are and how to integrate them or what's really going on there, and from people that are feeling that they that direct democracy represents an enfranchisement of self and self-voice, and for them to think past the point of it being about themselves. I don't think that those kinds of the personal values are often, we don't often focus enough on those, and instead we focus on how the process is supposed to be, is supposed to develop, or what kind of modifications we can make to the process to save us.
Because we're running out of time, I think we're going to keep responses to a minimum and just allow people to speak. In the corner, you had your hand up. Jessica Nagazzi.
Actually, I want to follow up on something Brooke said, and it comes back to a claim, Blake, that you made. I think what Brooke has raised is a difficulty about trying to get our minds wrapped around what parasitism is. Is the person who's got, you know, several kids and doesn't have and has to spend a lot of time with them and therefore doesn't have the time to spend in doing some of the work of an organization, is that parasitism? Or is the person who is poor and is working a couple of low-level jobs and doesn't have the time, is that parasitism? I think sometimes becomes, if we're going to use a distinction between the people who do the work on the one hand and parasites who don't on the other, we're going to have to get, I think, a clear distinction of what those, where the dividing line is between them. And I think Brooke's question raises the issue of how clear a dividing line we're actually going to be able to come up with.
No, not right this second. I don't want to.
I was just thinking from the examples you gave, it sounded like the problem is less with direct democracy and more with like the organization and membership requirements. And if your organizations, if you can make decisions and you don't have to do any work, then what is the basis of the organization? And I think that's a question that a lot of anarchist organizations are dealing with right now. Is it around a tactic? Is it around an identity group? Is it around a geographic region? And I think these are all problematic because they attribute some sort of like position that you take on things to some sort of positionality instead of like coming up with a politic that you base it on. And I think you can examine that with the examples you gave, I guess.
An experience with my own workers' cooperative that I've been, myself and a few others have been trying to organize for about 2 years now. We had a high level of parasitism in the context of this conversation occurring. And we sort of felt like, you know, why aren't these people as involved in doing the core administrative work as the rest of us are? You know, there's three of us that are doing heavy duty amount of organizing, putting 60 hours a week into this, and then there's some people that are just kind of doing the work in the terms of the work that brings in capital and taking our capital and doing other projects with it. And so a small-term solution to that that seems to be working a little bit is that we, you know, had like a bit of a retreat regarding it, and talked about what is our long-term goal in this workers' cooperative, and what are we trying to establish, and what kind of alternative working model are we trying to offer to other people in the society, or in like a post-revolutionary context? Like, what do we want the end product of this cooperative model that we're forming to be? And what that was. Well, that's a large model. It's a large thing of what we're trying to create. But I guess by putting a long-term goal and having discussions about the long-term goal within the cooperative, it reinstigated like excitement about what people were trying to do. And then people said, hey, I don't just want to be a worker bringing in capital anymore. I want to be a worker trying to work towards this long-term goal of a more like egalitarian work structure that people can, you know, participate in and share. So we had, that was a bit of a solution to the parasitism at our cooperative.
Maybe I say something, because I feel like, I think the question Brooke raised about, you know, membership and division of work and who's able to put in large amounts of time into activist groups is an important question. And interesting, if you look at OCAP, where in that example, you know, the membership is predominantly homeless, poor people. So, you know, there's questions there and different ways of examining it. But I feel like the word parasitism, which I'm pretty sure Blake and I used predominantly to talk about a ruling class enriching themselves in a capitalist process, wasn't meant to then be transposable onto small-scale collectives where people are doing less work. That's a separate problem. It's less... Exploitation is what you use to describe people who enrich themselves off the labor of others. Organizational difficulty and burnout is what you use to describe, I think, what happens when part of a collective isn't doing work and another part is, for whatever reason. And I'm not sure what you meant, but my understanding of this was never that parasitism could be... It was a term we were using to describe people who weren't doing work except as a capitalist class that was, like, basically enriching themselves. And so where that comes in, then, to our analysis is that you just shift... If you shift the focus of understanding what is wrong with society at large from it being undemocratic to it being exploitative... you come up with maybe significantly different ways of instantiating direct democracy or ways of working towards a solution to that problem. And so an example maybe I'd use to clarify what I meant by parasitic and that shift in focus is that I was on an anti-G8 caravan this past year, and we are doing a lot of presentations. And particularly in the States, people always remarked on how our presentation was a lot different from others they'd heard of when talking about the IMF and the World Bank, because we used the term exploitation and talked about their practices as exploitative instead of in terms of being undemocratic institutions that don't represent the people. And I think then the solutions and the way you organize might change significantly if you look at processes of capitalist exploitation than if you just, you know, because there's nothing really fundamentally morally superior or politically superior about exploiting people by consensus through a democratic process. Yeah. Then, you know, it doesn't really matter. And so I think that was where parasitism, if we misspoke on that, I don't know, do you agree with that distinction? So just, yeah, because I'd hate to say start, like, the movement off on this, you know. And then the word parasitism to describe all the people who don't pull their weight in collectives enter it because, you know, that would be bad. So. There's Sandra, and then... Wasn't there a list already?
Or I think was that was, finished? You spoke already.
Okay.
Commissioner Burr?
Yeah, I think that what we're talking about here is informal power structures that come up around the amount of work people do and informal hierarchies. And I think it's kind of problematic to think of people, I mean, I wouldn't even use the term parasite, but to think of people who do less work as being somehow inferior or like in a hierarchy of work as like not pulling their weight even. I wouldn't even say that. It's just like, in collectives, people do as much as they're able to do, I think. And I think we have to think of better ways of organizing ourselves so that it facilitates people to be able to do the amount of work that they're able to do, rather than like forcing people to do 40 hours worth of work a week when they're unable to do that for whatever reason. And so I guess I'm taking issue with thinking of the way we organize our collectives as exploitative when I know what you're getting at is that it can look like the collective is sort of exercising some kind of domination over a smaller part of the collective, like a committee, and that's obviously something that we want to find ways of correcting. But I don't think that that is an exploitative relationship in the way that capitalism exploits workers, and so I think that we have to find ways of of getting people within collectives who aren't doing enough work but who maybe want to do more work more involved, and people who are doing too much work and don't want to be doing that much work less involved, and find ways of like sharing the work in ways that don't feel like you're being dominated by other people. But I would really hesitate to think of the way we organize ourselves in terms of capitalist exploitation. I don't think that that's really the same mechanism that's at play at all.
Just to play off of something that was said over here and to look forward a bit, like a large part of what maturity means to me in like an anarchist democratic system, and what I see as needing to be further developed is taking like you're talking about kind of personal values, things like respect and trust, and taking those things and putting the effort into figuring out how those things can be translated into like a more sophisticated system, like a more, I guess, a more mature democratic process. And yeah, I guess
My question relates to one of the examples that was brought up earlier, the clock example of a General Assembly making a decision that a certain committee has to follow out and do the work. And it's sort of, you didn't say it outright, but it made it seem sort of top-down or coercive in a way. And I'm trying to think through the possibility of workers' self-management and workplaces or what have you in a post-revolutionary society, and the same kind of thing happening. Whereas if you have a workplace assembly, a majority makes a decision for what the workplace is going to do, and there's going to be a minority that has to, you know, unless you're using some kind of consensus process or something that I sort of think is unfeasible in large-scale society, but there's going to be a minority that sort of doesn't want to do what they have to do. I sort of feel like that's part of living in a society with sort of interconnections of needs and desires, where we have to sometimes do things that we don't want to do. But I think we need to think about ways to reduce that as much as possible, so that people can be doing the kind of things that they're interested in and want to do and decide on their own. And I'm wondering, without the use, if we want to reduce coercion as much as possible and reduce having to do things that we don't necessarily agree with or decided on, how do we go about doing that without trying to build a more democratic way of deciding on things, a more open way for minority positions to put their voice forward and to discuss those things through forms of, you know, whether, you know, we're talking about assemblies, we're talking about forms of open media, I would assume both, and more forms of democratic process and ways for people to voice their opinions on things. So I mean, it doesn't mean someone has to exactly answer, but it seems like we can go in sort of two directions, and it seems like an open and democratic way for deciding things should be our focus on this.
We're, I think, 2 minutes away from ending this, so I'm going to just, I guess, ask for the last call for speakers. Okay.
I just wanted to add that book that I mentioned, Rand's Lecture in Politics, the euphemism that was begun to be used about this is called demarchy. I don't know if this is something people look for.
And there was one more speaker.
Just a quick statement, I guess. With the Valley Anarchist Organization, half of the people in it work. I work several jobs and still have the time to do it. It can be done if you work and you have to do activism at the same time, but something that really should be thought about, I don't think it is, when a lot of activist circles, is how much privilege a lot of people in activist circles have to spend all their time. And I know that people do think about this, but it is a big issue. And what kind of projects activist groups get involved in, that people that do work shitty jobs all day would have the enthusiasm and the energy to put the same amount of time into. So obviously, like, some sort of kind of compromise could be met, but that really, the kind of privilege needs to be really thought out in activist organizations that have the time to put that much work into activist orientated projects. That's the same.
I just wanted to make one or two comments here. one of the things I think we're sort of trying to counter is, like, there's a sort of argument that happens in a lot of anarchist collectives, anarchist groups, or anarchist-oriented groups, that you get sort of a small group within the group that does a lot of work, and then they start, you know, knowing what's going on more and having more weight and taking more decisions. And I think there's a standard, or not a standard, but there's a critique that happens quite often that this is becoming an informal hierarchy, in the sense that, you know, there's a small minority of people who have more weight in the organization. But I think that's okay. Like, I think that what we're sort of responding against is the idea that that it's their fault that they're becoming elitist. I think, I like the idea that you're saying about, like, instantiating more more sort of personal values. And I'd say that, like, the anarchist movement, the problem is not that we're undemocratic. I think the problem is that we're not hardworking enough. We don't have enough initiative. We don't have enough revolutionary discipline.
I have a sick desire to end the presentation there, but if people... I mean, there's a lot of different... We're out of time, but if you want to go ahead, go for it.
Sorry. I don't know. I hope this comes out right. And this isn't any answer. It's just more questions around talking about democratically organizing and organizing in with predominantly white groups. And, like, what is that democracy? And especially when you're organizing around issues where you're not the most impacted. Like, I know, like, when you're working with OCAP, and I don't know the makeup of CLAC and the privilege that's there or not, but, like, OCAP being organized of predominantly poor people, and I don't know if CLAC is, most of the people involved in CLAC are predominantly poor, but how does democracy and the way that you organize and your accountability to those most impacted by it, I think that really needs to be looked at as well, and not just, like, the self-organization of the collective, especially if it's a very, very privileged collective of people.
I think, can we end it there? And there's a whole bunch of people I want to talk to you personally after, but is that good? Okay, happy lunch. Thank you.